All right, welcome back. Good evening, everyone. So I was just talking with some teacher trainee colleagues, some people I went through my teacher training with this over just yesterday, and just reflecting on how the experience of teaching online has been and teaching with this midst of COVID-19 and the difficulty shared across. And one of my friends was talking about how all the kalashas, all the senses of greed and hatred and delusion were very prominent. And yet there's also the easy access to the paramis, to the sense of those qualities of heart, and how this extreme time in our lives can be so pertinent for training, for practice, such an important time to practice very fully, very diligently. The sense of urgency is shared by all of us. Another friend was teaching a residential or a non-residential retreat online, and how one person was sharing how they were in a small group, and in that small group, they could hear the sirens going in the background of this person who lived in Italy. And just all that I could hear, just siren after siren, and how this common experience of suffering touches us across the globe, across the world. So tonight I'd like to do the third talk on consciousness, this link of the dependent origination that we've been exploring these weeks together. I'd like to explore consciousness from two folds, from two aspects. One is consciousness that creates a sense of self, consciousness that is imbued into this sense of becoming, the sense of who I take myself to be. And the second is consciousness which is beyond self, that does not lead to the creation of self, is not part of this mechanism of self-creation. Another way to frame those is the consciousness which is narrow, which is contracted, consciousness that's plugged into that sense of selfing. We go into craving, we go into clinging, plugged into this dependent origination. Or wide consciousness, consciousness which is not leading to suffering, that's beyond that sense of becoming. Consciousness that's unbounded, without location, without place, a sense of expanding beyond our normal confines of self, of restriction, of constriction. So exploring this first aspect, this narrow consciousness, this is really what we've been exploring this whole month, is how the consciousness narrows down, contracts around a particular sensescape, such as sight, hearing, smell, thought, etc., and how that consciousness shapes the very way we perceive the world. It literally creates the sense of environment, the sense of what we are attuned to in one moment versus not. What we see, what we ignore, and how this sets up this condition, this process of selfing, of creating a sense of me moment after moment after moment, and how mental consciousness tends to predominate this whole field of these six consciousnesses. So narrow, I think, is a nice way to explore it and to get a handle on it, this type of consciousness. Because when we're gripped by something, when we're really caught by something, our vision literally does narrow down. It becomes almost impossible to focus on something else. We focus around some particular area of sense data. And this primes the pump to go into self-making. It's like being on the top of a water slide. And just before you go down the entrance is that moment of consciousness. The moment of I'm attuned to fear. I'm attuned to craving, whatever it might be. And I slip into that water slide. And before I know it, I'm down the twists and turns of this sense of self and the suffering that's inherent with that. For example, something as simple as a physical sensation. Now, if it's held in this quality of spaciousness, this quality of non-reactivity, it's simply noticed, it's simply felt. But so often when a physical sensation arises in us, it quickly ties in to this mechanism of selfing. So let's say, for example, you're hanging out today in your home and you feel a tickle in your throat. You feel a little bit of a cough, or perhaps you have a headache. Before COVID-19, you would have thought, oh, it's just a seasonal hay fever, nothing to worry about. But pretty quickly, our mind jumps in and says, what if this is the beginning of COVID-19? What if I've caught it? And right now, the mind is off to the races. It jumps in. Jumps in with a quality of, once we have this thought that this is COVID, it's off and running. You know, who gave this to me? Who might I have, who I've exposed? How can I get a test? If I need care, will I be able to get that? Will I have to go to one of those field hospitals? How warm are those? You know, will I die? Will I cause others to die? And very quickly, the mind goes down this path. And this is the mechanism of selfing, of dependent origination that we're exploring this entire year. Our world in that moment becomes very narrow, very contracted. It excludes a whole array of sense data. It excludes the beautiful cherry blossoms. It excludes the sound of the bird in the springtime and focuses on the sense of worry, the sense of obsession. And so one way we've worked with it this month is learning how to recognize when our mind contracts around a particular field of consciousness and learning to shift intentionally to another area of consciousness. Because in any moment, there's so many different things available to us. The sights, the sounds, the smells, the tastes, the sensations. This is the power of intentionality, of choosing where our attention rests and how do we engage with what it's resting upon. And so much of our life struggle is around this gripping nature of consciousness. The Buddha described this very dramatically in the Fire Serum, where he said, "Monks, all is burning. What is burning? The eye is burning. Forms are burning. Consciousness at the eye is burning. Contact at the eye is burning. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experiences pleasure as pain, as neither pleasure nor pain, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. Burning, I tell you, with birth, aging, death, with sorrows, lamentations, pains, distress, and despairs." And he goes on to the eye is burning, the ear is burning, the nose is burning, the mind is burning. It's such a powerful way of describing the suffering that's inherent in this way the consciousness ties us in to the sense of becoming, the sense of taking birth into this sense of self. This narrowing of consciousness. Now, this narrow consciousness, this narrow relationship or quality of consciousness, sets up future consciousnesses to also be narrow. This is kind of the predicament that we're in. This is why it's called the wheel of samsara, is that our reactivity to this moment predisposes that to very reactivity arise again. Our suffering leads to our ignorance, which leads to our choices and impulses, the sankharas, which leads to how consciousness is shaped, which is then leads to how we interpret and react to this moment, which is the cycle that goes on and on. To quote the famous Laurel and Hardy, well, here's another nice mess we've gotten ourselves into. You know, again and again, suffering again and again. Why does my mind keep doing this? Why again and again? All is burning. All is on flame. And we keep throwing fire. We keep throwing fuel on our own fires of suffering. So at this point, if this was a movie, this would be the low point of the movie. When our heroine has lost everything, it's dark and despair. There's no hope for anything to happen. Impossible odds. This is dukkha. This is suffering. Now, lucky for us, the Buddha didn't just teach about suffering. He also taught about the origin of suffering and the cessation of suffering and the path to the end of suffering. It's not a one noble truth tradition. Right? We have these other truths. So learning to really touch into the depth of our suffering is just the starting point. Learning to see how suffering arises is the next step. This is what dependent origination is all about. This is literally the second noble truth. And this origin of suffering, this creation of suffering, is all about the creation of self, creating the sense of me and taking that as being true, absolutely true. A sense of self that is constant, is not changing, is always present. Now, you know, there's a caveat here that we need to develop a healthy sense of self, a self-esteem, a sense of who we take ourselves to be in the world. This is a healthy developmental process. But ultimately, we have to even look at that sense of self as being something that's transitory, insubstantial, conditioned, at its essence empty. So going back to consciousness as this narrowing, this narrow quality, it creates this really this set of parameters, this almost a prison that we operate from. And this is what my mind is gripped upon, the sense of self is oriented around in this moment. The walls are what that create that mechanism of self that we play in or suffer in. It's how we define ourselves, how we define others, shaped by our ignorance. This is the field that we live and operate in. We don't notice is how often that re-arises moment after moment and falls away. We connect all the dots to make this constant sense of self. If you notice how the sense of you, the sense of who you are, changes. There's times that you feel maybe in and joyous, sometimes scared, sometimes angry. That sense of self has arisen and has fallen away each of those times. A famous verse from the Dhammapada, the short sayings from the Buddha, is that though many a birth in samsara I have wandered in vain, seeking the builder of this house, repeated birth is indeed suffering. This phrase itself is pointing toward dependent origination, this wheel of samsara, many a births, many a deaths, whether it's through literal lifetimes or the lifetimes that arise in each life, each moment. The next verse is, O house builder, you are seen. You will not build this house again. You will not build this house again. For your rafters are broken and your ridgepole shattered. My mind has reached unconditioned. I have obtained the destruction of craving. The sense of unconditioned. I've obtained unconditioned. This is the transformation from this narrow consciousness, which is tied to the sense of samsara, the sense of suffering, into the consciousness which is beyond the self, that is outside the self, the unconditioned. Sometimes we talk about the unconditioned as the deathless. What remains when that fire goes out, that fire of craving, of delusion, of hatred? When that goes out, it's not like there's a complete void. There's a sense of fullness that's still there that's outside the sense of self. So you can start to frame this as wide consciousness as a way to get a hint or a access point into it. So wide consciousness means it doesn't lead to selfing, at least the way I'm using it tonight. That sense of knowing, that sense of awareness doesn't lead into this pathway of clinging, of craving, of selfing, of suffering. And this is something that if we reflect, we have more access to than we may realize. Just that moment of seeing something and not having to make a big deal about it, not having to voice your opinion around it, trying to get more of it or less of it. When you simply abide with that, perhaps during the meditation, if you're able to expand that sense of what's knowing, that sense of consciousness, to something which is much broader, much expansive. In that expanding quality, the sense of self becomes much quieter, perhaps even falls away. So subjectively, when our consciousness broadens in this way, it does feel, has a sense of wideness, a sense of vastness, has a sense of expanding beyond our normal confines. Now contrast that for a moment with our normal, contracted, narrow consciousness. Subjectively, it feels like I am feeling this. I am having this emotion. I am upset. I am happy. And I need to do something about it. I need to fix it. I need to change it in some way. So when the consciousness expands, it's like something is experiencing this moment, but it's not in this contained in this narrow sense of me, this narrow sense of I. It's like the whole room, the whole world is sensing, is feeling, is seeing. This is subtle, and it often, you know, there's this strong power of delusion, of ignorance, to keep us really enmeshed in this sense of a contracted, narrow consciousness. But yet, I think if we relax and just notice that the self is okay, I don't have anything to do in this moment. Other than to simply notice, other than to simply rest with what's arising. All our instructions point toward this again and again. How can we learn to see life without having to change it, without having to influence it? From day one, our meditative instructions point toward this. Just simply notice without having to do anything with. Another aspect of this broad, this wide consciousness is a sense of being unbounded, without location, without place. Usually we look out and there's a sense of me being in the center of my experience. I'm feeling this, I'm seeing this, I'm thinking this. Or you project that on someone else, you're having that experience. And when this consciousness expands outside of this dependent origination, becomes unbounded, without location, without place, there's the sense of what sees does this interesting shift or transformation. So what sees appears to be the same as what is being seen. That which sees becomes the same as what is being seen. There's not this place of referencing back to me. I am having this experience. It's not something that we can make ourselves do. We can't do a kind of mental trick to do that. It's something that we shift, fall into. It's just a happenstance of practice, of inquiry, of ripeness, that there's this shift of perspective from this narrow, confined sense of self to this absence of self. What we can do is practice well, practice in a way that we're not reinforcing that sense of me, that sense of self, practicing that quality of non-reactivity, the sense of vastness of knowing, of seeing. Back to that whole room. Now, when we experience that, when we touch upon that, it can be a bit disconcerting because, like, here's this assumption of me who's going through experiencing life. And suddenly there's a fundamental assumption that me, we see that as being false. of not being absolutely true, and something that we've based our whole life upon suddenly isn't present. Just like, where is that? It's always been there, and now it's not there. That sense of me looking out, me experiencing, falls away. Sometimes it fades. It becomes softer, more and more thin, more and more opaque, softening. Sometimes it falls away. The house ceases. O house builder, you are seen. You will not build this house again, for your rafters are broken and your ridge pole shattered. My mind has reached the unconditioned. I've attained the destruction of craving. A sense of lack of location. So sometimes that feels a bit of a free fall, like you're falling without a place of ground. So it's important to ground ourselves, you know, find that contact with the earth to orient. Because it's often just a point of readaption as our mind becomes more and more accustomed to this new way of relating to life. Another aspect of this broader consciousness that's outside of this dependent origination is a sense of separation, the sense of me versus you, me versus this other thing falls away. That perception of I looking out, I experiencing, soften, fades, or can fall away suddenly. The sense of self and other disappears. There's not that subjectiveness of difference. There's still the relativeness. There's still the sense of, okay, I know which gender I might use for a bathroom. There's still the sense of knowing what work I have to do, what role I have to put on. But instead of the role being what defines you, it becomes something that you put on like a set of clothes to go do your job. But it's not who you are. It's not what you are. Another aspect of this shift of consciousness is that the impulse to do, to fix, falls away. There's a sense of deep perfection in this moment. There's not something that needs to be altered or changed. This mechanism of selfing, this mechanism of suffering is interrupted. And with that interruption is all the language, all the footsteps, all the tracks of that sense of self. It's so hard to sometimes see that sense of self because it's so embedded, such a deep premise. But we can see its expression through our reactivity, through our a sense of contraction, or a sense of opinions that I know I am right and you are wrong. Or I know that I am less than you, I'm a failure compared to you. All these are the languages of the sense of self. So that can fall away when this consciousness shifts. Again, this could be just a taste of it. It could be a few moments. It could be something that's much more abiding and much deeper. There's a pausing, a stopping. All the activity to improve, to overcome, it just doesn't make sense. There's no me to improve. There's no me to shift. That's one of the pitfalls of the spiritual practice is we can sometimes co-opt the whole practice as a way to improve ourselves, to kind of buy into this whole sense of self and polish up this piece and that piece. And certainly most of us do need some polishing. There's no doubt. But that's not the ultimate purpose. The ultimate purpose, as the Buddha says, to see the house builder, to see it so clearly that the house is no longer built. This is what the Buddha pointed to in the famous Sutta, the Bahiya Sutta, in the famous line as he's instructing this monk, this devotee of the spiritual practice, how to practice in the right way, because he was practicing in a way that wasn't so helpful. And the Buddha said to this really earnest, sincere person, "When for you there will only be the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahiya, there is no you in connection with that. When there's no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. It's the end of selfing. So this is the wider consciousness, the shifting into, we're not into the part of the aspect of selfing. That falls away. It's not leading to more suffering, more of a sense of meanness. So often we have a taste into this, an opening into this. It may last for just a few moments. It may last for a few hours or days. Sometimes, you know, rarely it lasts forever. But often we re-engage in our lives. And with that re-engagement, there's that sense of self that also arises with that. Sometimes in particular areas, sometimes in all aspects, this power of delusion reasserts itself. And sometimes this can be a very discouraging time because we thought, oh, I'd finally gone through. I'd finally finished. And yet my wife says something and I find my heart contracted around that criticism or that sense of defensiveness that I feel, right? And so that's where the practice deepens, that willingness to turn toward all those nooks and crannies of our lives. And still there's that orienteering principle, that orienteering taste, that glimpse of that possibility of consciousness beyond the sense of self. And it's actually something that is not far away. It's actually available to us in any moment, in any instant. We just have to be willing to drop that mechanism of selfing to discover what is already here. And so then we bring this back, this process, this understanding back into our practice. It transforms the very way that we practice. We understand what selfing really is. We become more and more sensitive to that. And noticing, can I speak without holding my opinion so strongly? Can I practice without agenda, without a goal or an outcome? Can I meet someone with the vulnerability of my heart without the fear of contraction, which ties me back into this whole narrow consciousness? And this time, the whole world is suffering. We're all suffering together in a way that I think is so rare, so unique, and in some ways so precious. We can tap into that sense of interconnection. If you realize that my suffering is shared by people across the globe. Now, what can be helpful in this shift toward this wider consciousness, from this narrow consciousness that so much of our lives is focused around? It's almost this shift of perception of where that's located, that sense of perceiving. For most of us, when we consider what's the locus of perception, it's usually our head. You know, our eyes, our sense organs are all oriented around here. And there's the body, of course, but, you know, the body is often forgotten, disconnected from. And we can sit and practice with this wider and wider consciousness as if the whole room is sensing, is perceiving. Right? And even that sense of widening, as if with the head as the center, there's still a subtle quality of location. There's a sense of me being in the driver's seat, of me choosing to be present, to have a sense of control or agency. A bit of protection, perhaps, a sense of being a little removed, a little isolated, a sense of rationalization that may arise. So imagine that sense of perception shifting from the head down to the heart, as if the heart is in the middle of what is perceiving. The heart is as expansive as this room, expansive as the world. As we do that, we may find that there's a greater quality of vulnerability, of immediacy, of being available to life. Some spiritual teacher once said, We are not here to change the world. The world is here to change us. And when we allow our consciousness to shift down into the heart as the center of this, of what is knowing, then there's a way that the world does affect us. It changes us in a way that the head itself keeps us insulated from. And that further and further expansion. And you can start to see, as you, the further you expand, the less the smaller the sense of orientation is, the sense of me is in the midst of that. Becomes more and more diluted, more and more insignificant. And you can start to see that sense of me in itself is no different than what is being perceived. Now, if you do this and you start to get this sense of this much broader consciousness, again, from the narrow familiar, remember that word familiar consciousness. This is what's known. This is our assumptions, what we've based our life upon. You start to open to this broader part and you feel a tinge of fear, perhaps a lot of fear, you know you're on the right track. The fear actually is a good guidepost, a very reliable guidepost, that you're going beyond what is known. That's the, what do you call it, the part of the honey that keeps us trapped in the pit of origination, that it's familiar, it's what we know, it creates that sense of certainty. And that willingness to start to release that and releases from us, there's that fear that arises because we're not so much in control. You know, we want to back up. We want to retreat back. Just to respect that, to know that. O house builder, you are seen. You are not build this house again, for your rafters are broken and your ridge pole shattered. And a further shift even of the locus of consciousness is down into the body. In the sense, this idea of impermanence, of things arising and fading, this becomes very real as we open to the very nebulous, opaque quality of sensations of the body. The sense of body falls away. In this way, consciousness can start to become more and more unbounded, uncontained. And then words like faith, words like surrender become very important in our practice because we realize I can't do this. I can get myself right to the door, but I can't make the door open. Something else pulls us through. See, this large part of why we keep our consciousnesses narrow and contracted is control, is to try to create this sense of certainty, the sense of order. I create the sense of self to confront this lack of certainty. That's why our minds are so busy trying to solve these problems, trying to create a sense of certainty from my mind. And how well does that work? How well are we able to make life go the way we want? You know, how many of us expected their spring time to look different than it is now? How many plans have dissolved, have fallen away? Because of this new situation, this new urgency to care for ourselves and everyone around us. So to release this narrow sense of consciousness embedded in suffering, it does take a quality of surrender, a quality of faith, that by doing so, my suffering will fall away, that there's not this annihilation that we fear, that the world will continue to unfold, that my life will continue to be present, to present itself moment after moment. And in fact, that we become part of this arising and passing away in a joyous way, in a spontaneous way, as our hearts become unbounded, become liberated. All right, thank you for your attention. And if you could just sit quietly for a few moments and let those words settle. And in a few moments, we'll have a chance for some questions. I'm going to pull up the homework for this week and post it for you. Okay, I'm going to send out throughout the, what do you call it, internet here. And just to read it to you all. And I see there's some questions already. We'll get back to you in a second, Brooke. Okay, so there's the homework for this week. And just to read it for you, that consciousness beyond self. Notice how consciousness usually has a narrow quality to it when it feeds into this sense of struggle, resistance, or wanting. That's the language of the self. That's the expression of the self. Practice allowing consciousness to be wider and more expansive. Not holding to any one thing too strongly allows it to become less bounded and restricted. And what happens to this sense of self when consciousness widens and broadens? Explore this week and see what arises. All right, so it looks like Brooke has a question. So let me see if I can unmute you or if one of the co-hosts can help me with that.
I think I'm unmuted, yeah.
Yes, you are. And just for everyone else, if you have a question, go in and send a chat to everyone or to myself, probably to everyone would be good. And then the co-host can help me unmute. Okay, Brooke. So you said, why does consciousness or?
I couldn't understand you. So
okay.
Did you say why consciousness or white consciousness?
I didn't say white consciousness.
Okay. That's what I just want to make sure.
I mean, yeah, we could explore that because that's certainly, there's a way that we are, our white consciousness, our cultural consciousness is a profound way of shaping reality.
Uh-huh.
But you said why consciousness. What context was I using that?
You said it, you were talking about the second type of consciousness.
Oh, okay. I think I actually meant
from ourselves.
Why it is W-I-D-E.
Oh, W-I-D-E. Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Yes, yeah, that makes more sense.
Wide, thank you.
Yeah, wide versus narrow. You know, when our consciousness narrows down and contracts down, that's we're tied into that sense of self. When it's much wider and broader, there's a receptivity that's available. There's a sense of non-agenda. And part of what's happening is we're stepping outside this wheel of samsara, this wheel of dependent origination.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Anyone else have any questions? So if you go down to the bottom of the screen under chat, you could just type something or you could just say, I have a question, whatever you like. Yeah, this talk, I was trying to expand the idea of consciousness beyond just this narrow contraction that we usually fall into, to realize that consciousness also has this much broader way of perceiving. All right, so we have another question from Sarah. How do you work with the fear?
Yeah, hi, Tim.
Hi, Sarah.
Just wondering about It's good to know that it's natural, but how to hold that fear?
Yes. Yeah, so the fear, you know, part of it was we have to recognize why it's there. You know, in a deep level, it's really about survival. That if we're not, the assumption we have, and it's a very deep assumption, that if I'm not in control, if I'm not in charge of things, if I'm not in the center of my world, then I'm not surviving. I'm not existing. You know, so that's, it's important to be respectful of that fear and not to, you know, plow through it with too much force or too much disregard for that. And so some things to help with that are to notice how the fear comes up. There's a sense of, okay, I'm not bounded. I'm not contracted the way I was, and I'm not sure what I am. I'm not sure who I am. It's to spend time also, you know, connecting with the physicality of the body, you know, walking, moving the body in a way that grounds, that brings that sense of orientation. Doing things like, you know, start to prove to yourself that you can still work, you can still talk to people, even though that sense of fear isn't there, or is that sense of self is not as strong, or is not as established. Noticing how that sense of being able to act in the world is still available, even though that sense of self is becoming more shaky and less defined. And also notice how that fear, you know, okay, I don't know who I am or what I am if that sense of self isn't intact, isn't present. But on the other hand, notice how there's the plus side of it is this spontaneity, this availability, this ability to be with others in a alive, immediate way. And part of your second question was, is it good to know it is a guidepost, but how do we allow it? Can you say more about that, Sarah? Let's say you're, looks like you're muted. Let me see if I can unmute you here. There you are. Go ahead.
You answered that. I typed that before I was unmuted. You addressed it. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Anyone else have any questions or comments?
Hi, Tim.
Hi.
I couldn't quite absorb the homework. It seems to me that we got down to where this narrow quality of self is something with a resistance or wanting, and yes. All this. And then it says something about like practice with a wider sense.
Yes.
What I'm wondering is if you could give a practical. I don't find it's always easy for me to just tell myself to practice, you know, in that way. Can you give a practical step one? How would you release your narrow.
Sure. That's a great question. How would you release that narrow sense of self? How do you go into that broader sense of perception, of consciousness itself?
Yeah.
You know, first of all, it's always helpful to notice where you are to begin there. Mm. Because sometimes we want to get over ourselves. And in very getting over, there's a kind of inherent, you know, judgment or contraction, which tends to tighten everything up. It's like trying to, you know, play with a dog and trying to get the dog to let go of the sock. And the more you pull, the more the dog pulls back, right? So learning how to say, okay, you know, you got that sock pretty tight there in your jaws there, dog. You know, so you recognize that quality of narrowness, you know, and turn toward that with a sense of interest, of curiosity, of compassion. Passion too. And when you do that, when you turn toward it with a quality of compassion, you've already stepped a little bit outside of it. Because if you stay in the midst of that contracted, narrow view, and you add a secondary, narrow, contracted view of, I shouldn't be narrow or contracted, you've just tied yourself into a tighter knot. Right. So really acknowledging this is where you are. This is what's present. This is what is here right now. And meeting that, you know, not only with your knowing, but also with your heart and say, okay, I can touch into this quality of difficulty, of contraction. Right? Mm. And then once you get that little bit of a sliver, a little bit of spaciousness around it, see if you can let that spaciousness expand a bit. Okay. So we see we're doing, we're going in from the narrow sense of self that's contracted to something that's a little bit outside of that. It could just be like a hair breadth difference, a little bit of spaciousness. From that spacious quality, allow that to be a little bit broader. And maybe like the whole body is holding this narrow view, is holding this experience. And maybe expanding to, okay, maybe what's if the whole room, if I kind of let the boundaries go and let the whole room kind of hold it. Or maybe go into your closet and let your closet hold it, or whatever might feel accessible. Right? And then notice then how that can relate to that very state a little bit softer, a little bit more without so much clinging. Right? So that's the example of widening the view, allowing the view to become, the consciousness to become wider.
Yeah. Thank you. It's perfect.
You're welcome. Thank you, Kathy. All right. Anyone else? Give it a few more moments. Okay, looks like we got a question from Anna. So Anna wrote, I'm interested in the body-mind connection. In the house builder verse, he says the mind is freed, and you're suggested that we move the locus of experience down to the heart center. Can you address that connection? Feels like the sense of self is in the body too. Right? Anna, is that, are you off, unmuted?
I am. Yeah. Do you need more clarification on the question?
Sure. Why don't you say it a different way?
Well, just, I noticed that that really jumped out at me that the suffering it comes from the mind. The sense of self is in the mind.
Yes.
And then suggesting that we bring the locus of experience down from where the sense doors are, you know, the sense organs, like you said, into the heart center. And I can feel that is helpful, but I also have a lot of sense of self in my body as well.
Yes.
So, I just had some confusion there. I thought, oh, if I'm in the body, then I'm not in the mind and I'm free. But that doesn't actually feel like my.
That's experience. Right. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So
thanks.
So yeah, it's a good clarification. So the sense of, first of all, that sense of moving from the mind locus of perception, of consciousness, let's say, to the heart is more of a suggestion of practice, a way of kind of shifting us out of the self focus. We can come into the heart and still very much be self-focused. There's still a sense of me being the open heart in the middle of all my experience, that I'm open to you, but there's a sense of me being open, right? Same thing with the body. We can, some of us have tremendous identification with the body, you know, whether the body is a place of pain, of suffering, of something we would rather not have there, or a sense of identity, like look how great my body is, or whatever it might be. You know, there's still that quality of identification. So in that verse, oh, house builder, you're seen. You're not build this house again. Okay, and he talks about how his, trying to find the part you quoted about the mind being freed. So in that case, the Buddha is talking about, my notes are all confused here. he's not talking about the mind in terms of our normal way of thinking of it. It's much more of the heart mind. It's much more of that sense of that location of self. That's really what this house builder metaphor is this mechanism of creating the self and the delusion that's tied with that. Wherever that self may manifest intellectually, may manifest through the nose, the mind, the body, the heart. And just culturally, we tend to be very head focused. So coming into that sense of the centeredness of the heart. But again, the big piece of that is that sense of me being in the middle of experience, when the perception gets wide enough, that falls away. So there's not a sense of me and you, it's a sense of just us. It's just a sense of experience itself.
Mm. That gives a new interpretation for ridgepole. Is that what it's called, the ridgepole? Like, because you said that that's where the self is centered, and I thought, oh, if that thing is shattered, then yeah, there's no hard center anymore. The identity, the whole thing's busted open.
Yes, it's like the way I interpret that verse is that the ridgepole and the rafters, that's this kind of foundation of assumption, this foundation of ignorance, this belief in an isolated, separate sense of self, and how much momentum, how much tenacity that quality can have, right? And when we see that, you know, that arises, and there's a mechanism that keeps building it moment after moment, you know, throughout our lifetimes, there's a new sense of self, and we're going through school, or we're having a new relationship and ending a relationship. There's all these houses which are being built, and what is actually building that is this underlying process of ignorance, of delusion, this process of dependent origination. When we step out of that, we see that in itself as being an illusion, then there's that whole, that house falls apart, and the impulse to build falls apart. And that's where the fear comes up. Mm-hmm. But it was also, if you get through the fear, there's the joy beyond conditions. All right, thank you, Anna. All right, and then it looks like Cheryl or Sherry.
Hi, it's Sherry. Me.
Or Cheryl, sorry.
Yeah, when I think of the house builder, I also think of conditionality as part of dependent origination, the conditionality that we bring to the house. I mean, we keep building with the same materials. That's the way I kind of see that.
Yes.
In a way. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, the conditionality, the conditioned.
So notice those conditions until you start seeing them. Yeah, exactly.
That condition, that's a big piece of the Buddhist teachings, that everything, almost everything, is conditioned. It's based upon, you know, the substance, and in the case of the house builder, there's the timbers of that, and those all pieces come together to create that sense of me, of sense of self. Right? And when we have that perception, that sense of consciousness broaden and widen to such a degree, then that, if that's touching into the unconditioned, what's beyond conditioned.
Right. Beyond conditioned. I love that. It's fun to be able to try and find it.
Yes. Yeah. That sense of curiosity. Okay. What, you know, there's a sense of me that's here, obviously, but is there something beyond that? Is there something outside of that? And can I start to turn into that, start to notice that in a deeper and deeper level?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right, anyone else? All right, looks like we're coming to the end of questions. So next week, I'll be starting a new month, this time focusing on Nama Rupa, name and form. which is the next link in this cycle of dependent origination. So looking forward to that exploration. Just a couple of quick announcements that Carrie Peterson is offering a intro class starting this Wednesday, April 1st. That's going to be all online. So I'm excited to see how that goes. And I think it will be quite successful. And then Narayan is offering a non-residential on the Brahma Viharas, on loving kindness, on compassion, on sympathetic joy and equanimity, which is a very timely topic for this time. So thank you all for those who have offered Dana to myself and to Sims, and your support is very deeply appreciated.